It is my pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Vasilis Verios. Vasilis is a PhD student at the Computer Science Department in Stanford University. His advisor there is Professor Hector Garcia Molina. Vasilis works on various problems in data integration and data analytics. He was an intern in the DMX group a couple of years back, where he worked on data analytics. And in his PhD, he has basically studied how to combine algorithms and crowdsourcing to handle the difficult problem of entity resolution. And that's what he's going to talk about today. Okay, here you go.
Thank you, Kosik. Thank you for having me here. It's a great honor and pleasure. And thank you, everyone, for attending my talk. So my talk, as Kosik said, is about data integration, the process of combining data from multiple sources. And I will talk today about a new approach that combines the best of two worlds, the computing power of machines and the intelligence and cognitive abilities of humans. The last years, one of the hottest terms in industry and academia is big data. And many people have tried to define what big data really means. I think in most cases, the focus is on quantity. So in one sense, one of the aspects that has been overlooked is quality. And that's where I focus in my research. I'm trying to develop mechanisms and algorithms that can achieve a very high quality data integration outcome at a very large scale. So let me start with a simple example for data integration. Imagine we are a large car manufacturer and we want to combine sales data with data from social media and car forums in order to better understand what is happening with our sales. One example is there is a YouTube video, and this is about a serious engine issue. It causes a lot of bad publicity. We want to find out if this is one of the cars we are making. And we also want to find out if this exact topic that is being discussed in this video also is being discussed in computer forums. So there are some very hard tasks here to solve for existing AI solutions. One is if the car model does not appear in the title of the video, understanding what is the car model just by using the video content is still a very hard task for AI. Also, the video understanding and natural language processing tasks in order to find if that topic in the video is being discussed in a thread of a forum are very, very hard tasks, still, at least. So the last years, one of the approaches that has been proposed is to involve humans in those hard tasks. Say that we have an image, a posted image on Facebook, and we want to find out which is the car model in that image. What we can do is we can show that image to a human. We can also show an image from the catalog of all models of the manufacturer and ask a direct question, is this the same car model or no? Of course, humans also make errors. We need to deal with those errors. Part of my talk will also focus on handling human errors. And also we can also have some initial evidence. So for the image on the left, we can have some convolutional neural network that will be very confident that the image on the left is either a sixth generation Corvette or a seventh generation Corvette. So we can just ask questions for Corvette models. And we also need to quantify how much increasing our confidence for this specific image on Facebook will help us with an overall data integration task that we are trying to solve that involves thousands of images and posts on social media and forums. The term for this approach of involving humans is called crowdsourcing or human computation. There have been many platforms the last years where researchers or companies can post such small tasks. Actually, large companies like Google and Facebook, and I think Microsoft also, they have internal crowdsourcing systems where such small tasks can be issued to people. Some examples of larger tasks that are solved with crowdsourcing is constructing records for entities on web search in the direct answers we get for some actors or actresses, let's say. And another one is when we are removing duplicates from maps. So the main problem with crowdsourcing is scalability. A human needs around 10 seconds to answer one question like the one before. An image processing algorithm, an image comparison algorithm, will need something like 10 microseconds. So humans are much slower. And we, of course, need to pay them for their effort. So with a minimum wage rate, 10 seconds means 4 cents. So on one hand, we have fully automated approaches that can be applied on the larger scale. But still, for some hard tasks, the accuracy is rather low. And on the other hand, we can naively apply crowdsourcing. We will get a better accuracy for those hard tasks, but only at a very small scale. So my research is about building hybrid human-computer approaches that can be applied at the larger scale, and they can achieve an accuracy of at least as high as humans alone. And there are three main challenges in building hybrid scalable approaches. The first one is quantifying the amount of information each question to a human gives and asking only the most useful questions. The second one is a trade-off between latency, cost, and accuracy. So I think it's obvious that the more money we spend, the better accuracy we can get eventually for an overall task. And we will see that by spending more money, we can also find the overall outcome for a task, for an overall task, much faster. The third challenge is about the interface we use to ask humans questions. So in the previous example, I just had two images and a radio button. Another option could be to have multiple images from the data set on the left and multiple images on the right and try to match them somehow. In general, I'm interested in all aspects of data management and information management, especially data integration, data analytics, and data mining. I've also done some work in the past in cloud and pervasive computing. But in the talk here, I will just talk about those two projects that are in the intersection of data integration and crowdsourcing. So the first one, Waldo, it will show how to address the first and third challenges in building scalable hybrid approaches. The second will show how to address the second challenge. And in the last part of my talk, I will just say a few things about my plans for the future. So let's start with Waldo, which is on crowd entity resolution. First, let me tell you about entity resolution. In entity resolution, we are given a set of records. Each record refers to one entity, and we want to group together records that refer to the same entity. So here, the records are images. We want to create one cluster for Natalie Portman, one cluster for Keira Knightley, and one cluster for Will Ferrell. And the application, the obvious application for entity resolution is on web search. We search for an entity like Natalie Portman. We get on the right information aggregated from multiple websites. And we also get photos from many websites. So, and I don't know if Bing is using crowdsourcing for this, but I know that Google is using crowdsourcing to have a very high accurate, very accurate summary of information for an entity in web search. So in crowd entity resolution, we start with some initial evidence. In the example I have here, we have a face landmark extraction algorithm that will process its image, extract landmarks, and then we can compare those landmarks and compute the probability that the two images show the same person. And then we also ask humans directly. We show them two images. We ask them if they see the same person or not. I should make clear here that in crowd entity resolution, we don't just have images of people as a case. We can have records that have video, they have text, natural language, structured information from relational database, databases. And the entities could be wristwatches, or they could be some other type of product, or restaurants on a map. So the examples I will use here will have images of people, but this is just a use case. And the problem in crowd entity resolution is that we are given as an input this initial evidence. Based on this initial evidence, we can compute a clustering of the data set. And then we want to refine this clustering by asking humans questions and converge to the ground truth clustering. The naive approach is we go and ask questions for every pair of images. So in a small data set of 10,000 images, we would have to ask 10 million questions, all pairs of questions, all pairs of records, and we would have to pay $2 million for 4 cents per question. So obviously, this naive approach will not work, even for a small data set like this one. We want to ask questions judiciously. So we want to quantify the amount of information each question gives us and ask only the questions that give the most bang for the buck. And one way to do that is to ask questions incrementally. So we can start with the initial evidence, which is, in this case, is this graph. We have for some pairs of records the probability that they show they refer to the same entity. And then we run a task selection algorithm. This is the core problem in crowd entity resolution that will select the pairs, the questions to humans that will best enhance the initial evidence for doing this clustering. We will get back some answers. We will run task selection again, this time taking into account the answers from the first round. And we will ask the best questions in this case. And this loop will go on until at some point we are very confident that the clustering we have is the ground truth clustering. And at that point, we will output the ground truth clustering or something that is close to the ground truth clustering. And to make it more clear why asking questions incrementally helps us, I have an example here of 4 images of Meryl Streep. So we have the initial evidence we have for the 2 images on the left tells us that it's very likely that those 2 images show the same person. Instead of going and asking in one step all the other 5 questions, we can go and ask one question for the 2 images on the top and one question for the 2 images on the right. Let's assume we get yes answers back. Let's assume there are no errors, just for simplicity. Through transitivity here, we can infer that all those 4 images refer to the same person and skip the other 3 questions. So we would have saved those 3 questions. Now, the main problem is that we still need 10 seconds for each answer. We will save questions with this incremental approach. But if we don't overcome this limitation, there isn't really hope for crowd entity resolution to scale. And actually, there is a way for reducing this amount of time by orders of magnitude. And this way is with a different interface for human answers. So in this interface, we include more records from a data set in each task. And we ask from people to give the same color to records referring to the same entity. And images and records that refer to a different entity will have a different color. And actually, there is one more key point here, that we allow users to leave some images without a color. So here, those 2 images that are left without a color are assumed to refer to a separate entity. Each of the images that doesn't have a color is a different entity by our definition and the instructions we give to the crowd worker that solves the task. So here, the user with 3 clicks tells us that there are 3 entities in this task. And yes?
Is it a more expensive and error-prone task compared to your previous?
The overall amount we have to pay, yes, it will be. We will have to pay more, but we get more information back. And if we normalize the dollar per bit of information, as I will show in a little bit, it's much. That's how we decrease really the amount of time per answer per bit of information. So that's the key point here. So, yeah, yes?
Do we know if this is more error prone from the human perspective compared to simple yes, no?
Exactly, exactly. That's exactly where this part of my... So it's there is a trade-off between accuracy and time efficiency and accuracy. So, yes?
So the skipping pairs that you were talking about, you said that, I mean, what's your point that you won't be able to skip too many pairs? Because that depends on, you know, you want to skip the easy... Basically, there are very easy cases, which are either they are very clearly they are the same entity or very clearly they are very different entities.
Yes.
It depends on what fraction of pairs are of that kind.
Yes.
Like if there are lots of that kind, then you will be able to skip a lot.
Yes.
So it might actually save you a lot. It depends on really the characteristics of the data set.
It's absolutely true. So the best thing we can do is we can have a linear number of questions to the size of the data set. Let's say we just ask one question for each, one pairwise question for each image in the data set. That's the best we can do. And in some portions of the data set, we will be quadratic. But even this, even let's say we can go linear with a linear number of questions. If we have to wait for 5, 10 seconds for each question, for large data sets, this is a lot of time. So the key idea is that we can go much, much faster with the second interface. But there is a trade-off, like Sudipto said. So
are you building a model here, or is there any kind of generalization that's happening, or is it, how do you know if you see some new entities, whether they're instances of entities you've seen before, or do you have to start from scratch for those new entities?
There is an underlying model, and I didn't go a lot into what are the details of this model. But for every portion of the data set, we have some initial evidence. And what we do really in practice, we have some blocking mechanism that will, if there is a portion of the data set that we are absolutely sure that refers to a different entity, we will never try to connect it with some records, some portion of the data set from some other block. We do skip. That's the question, right?
So I guess the similarity measure isn't necessarily changing. I mean, in some sense, you treat it as a black box.
Yes. Actually, in this work, everything is fixed. The initial evidence, your similarities, the machine learning algorithm that produces those evidence, everything is fixed. You don't try to improve, to find out what features are better described if two records refer to the same entity. But there is one more work that we are currently working on that is trying to solve both problems at once. Improve, finding the right similarity thresholds on one hand, and at the same time, do the resolution for parts of the... Yes?
So is there any chance to just parallelize the tasks based on the different blocks of the data?
Yes. So in every round, we can be asking questions for different blocks of data. And so in that sense, we do it. And actually, this is a great way to do parallelization, because you know that if you ask one question from one block and another question from another block, it cannot be redundant. Like the answer that you get in that block will not help you somehow in another block. So going to the trade-off between time efficiency and let me make it a little bit more clear. So we have, with three clicks here, we get six answers back. We get one yes answer for the images with the same color, and we get five no answers. With four items, we get six answers back. With nine items, we get 36 answers back. With 16 items, we get 120 answers back. And as Sudipto said, the human attention is limited, so we must expect that people will miss some images that are the same, or they may make mistakes because the space is also limited. So there is this trade-off between time efficiency and accuracy and errors. And we had some preliminary experiments to see about to quantify this trade-off. And we used, so we ran experiments on Mechanical Turk, which is Amazon's platform for crowdsourcing. The data set we used is a data set of Stanford athletes. So this is my advisor collected this data set over the years. He's almost in all major sports events, he's there. He's taking photos of the athletes. And actually, the interesting thing about this data set is that it was very hard both for the fully automated approaches we tried and humans. So the fully automated approaches we tried eigenfaces, which is a more old traditional approach. We also extracted landmarks, as I had in my previous example. Oops. Oh. Did I do? Oh. Ah, great. Yeah. Thanks. So what we tried? We tried eigenfaces. We tried the phase landmark extraction. Oh, it will take some time. Yes. Yes.
So the initial evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Does it matter how you get that evidence, or at the end, what you expect from that step? For every pair, there's an initial similarity score for every pair of
images? Yes. So not for all pairs. So usually, what you do some blocking. You create blocks of records, and then in each block, you have similarities for every. For every pair inside the block, and you can translate the similarity into probability using some training examples. Yes?
So, I think the only follow up question is you could have many different techniques that produce those edges within the block.
Yes.
And how heavily is your technique influenced by the goodness of that?
Yes. So, there are in this work that I have here, where we are using a simpler model, it's not affected so much. We also have actually another work which is relying more on initial evidence, and it says I will not try to resolve everything with humans. I will rely on computer algorithms heavily, and will just try to improve a little bit. With humans. So in that case, you can, if you have really bad initial evidence, you can have an issue with, but it tries to save more, so it's, yes?
So after you get the feedback from the task, do you actually
want
to sort of update the model, or
like
retrain the model?
So we don't, in those works that I'm presenting here, we don't change, for example, the initial evidence. We don't. We will learn things about a pair of images. We will update the probability of two images showing the same person. We will also have an error rate for that pair, how difficult it is for humans. We will also update that. We may also go and update our what we know about that person that gave us the answer, how much of an expert he is or how much of a spammer he is. But we won't go back to the machine learning model and say, we have one more example here. Try to improve the weights in your model to come up with a new probability. Yes?
But you first mentioned that you can infer the probability between either pairs giving new evidence, we select, because some of them are trying to make some sense. So do you actually propagate
that? Oh, yes, yes. Oh. We do that, yes. But we don't change, let's say, we don't go back in the black box that has, for example, a logistic linear regression. Yes, logistic regression, and it says, I will change my weights here. So you will say that these are the weights, I'm fixing the weights, but through transitivity, my confidence on a specific pair changes,
okay.
Not the weights of the model that produced them.
Okay.
Yes. Actually, one of the works we are working right now is trying to do something like that. So we have similarity thresholds, And based on those, we try to find better thresholds by the answers we get back. So it works also on this level, adjusting the black box that generates the initial evidence. So yes, I was saying that this data set is difficult. We also tried Google Photos, because Google Photos can give you the entities. But 2 years ago that I tried it, it wasn't doing a good, like the precision and recall were both very low. I don't know, maybe now it's much better. But it's, you can see that it's a difficult data set by, for instance, on the image on the left, you can see there are many faces in the picture. There is clearly, for a human can clearly see that there is one entity of where the image is focusing, but there are many faces here that could be the face that we are trying to find. There are also cases where the athlete is upside down, or you can only see the side of his face, or the athlete is wearing a cap, like the image on the right. And you can see that even for humans, it's a difficult data set. You can see here, it's not easy to tell if those three images show the same person or not. So going to the to the trade-off eventually of time efficiency and accuracy. Let me start with the time efficiency. This is, and I'm not speaking about money, because you asked about money. Money and time, the effort of the worker is the same. You want like the minimum wage rate to be, or even higher, of course, but a specific rate to be satisfied. So on the x-axis here, you see the number of images we have in each task. And on the y-axis, you see the amount of time for each answer. So for instance, for a four-item task, the average number of time over around 6,000 tasks is 18 seconds. And there are six answers in a four-item task. We divide 18 by 6, we get the 3 seconds on the y-axis. And you can see that this normalized time per pair drops from 17 seconds for a pairwise task to less than half a second for a 12-item task. But if we see the error rate, we will see, again, the same x-axis. On the y-axis, the false negative rate, how often people will not spot that two images show the same person, while in reality they do. We see that we go from 10% for a pairwise task to more than 40% for 12-item tasks. And actually, things are much more interesting if we focus on the error rates for pairwise tasks and 9-item tasks. So I have a histogram here where we have the percentage of pairs with a specific error rate. If for a pair, 3 out of 10 answers were wrong, then this pair would fall in the 0.3 bucket here on the x-axis. So these are the errors when we include pairs in the pairwise task. And we see that more than 80% of the pairs have an error rate of 0.1, 10%. Now, if we, the same pairs of images, if we include them in a 9-item task, we will see a much more uniform distribution. And what this means is that there are some easy pairs of images where the error rate is almost the same, and there are some difficult pairs of images where the error rate goes much higher when we take them from a pairwise task to a 9-item task. And I have an example here to make it more clear. So this is an easy pair. It's very easy for a person to spot that those two, this actor and actress, they are different people. It's also very easy to spot that these two images show the same person. But for those two images, when they are included in a 6-item task, it's much more difficult. And of course, we all know, I guess, Meryl Streep. In real data sets, people will not know the entity, so there will be much harder pairs of records to be resolved. So the main observation in Waldo, in this project, is that there are some pairs of records that can be resolved with a much lower cost using the pairwise interface. And there are some pairs of images that can be resolved much more efficiently with a multi-item interface. And in this work, we try to use both interfaces. So now that we have the basic intuition for crowd entity resolution and what Waldo is trying to do, I have a more technical part in the talk where I will discuss about the main technical problem we are trying to solve, which is this task selection algorithm in this workflow of asking questions in rounds. So the input in the task selection problem is the initial evidence, the answers from the previous rounds, and we also have a budget for the current round and the cost for a multi-item task and a pairwise task. And you may be wondering how we decide this budget for the current round. This will be the second part of my talk, where I discuss budget allocation. So we are given an overall amount of money to perform a data integration task using crowdsourcing, and we want to split this amount of money into a number of rounds. So here we will just, this budget for the round will be an input to our problem. And for a budget and a cost for each task, there are many options. Here, for instance, we can issue in the current round 2 6-item tasks and 4 pairwise tasks. Though with the numbers that I have here, we fit this set of tasks fits the budget, and we also need to decide which records are placed in each task. So the overall problem is, amongst all those options for sets of tasks that we can send in the next round that fits the budget, to find the set of tasks that has the maximum utility. So there is a utility function that we have that expresses a very specific metric. This metric is really about our progress to the final goal, the ground truth clustering. I won't try to formally define the metric. I will just give you the intuition for the utility function. So the utility function, the example I have here for the utility function has a set of 3 tasks, 1 4-item task and 2 pairwise tasks. And we want to find what is the overall utility of this set of tasks. So this set of tasks covers a set of edges. Each edge is a pair of records if the 2 records are in the same task. And each of those edges contributes to the overall utility for this set of tasks. And there are 3 main properties for the utility of each edge. So the first one is that we compute the probability of the two respective images referring to the same entity using the initial evidence and the answers we have from previous rounds. The higher this probability, the higher the utility that this edge contributes. And the rationale here is that, as we saw before with transitivity inference with the 4 images of Meryl Streep, finding matches quickly accelerates the whole entity resolution process. The second one is that some of the edges are covered by multiple tasks, like those 2 images of Natalie Portman. We can see those 2 images in the 4-item task and in 1 of the pairwise tasks. So there is a diminishing returns property here, because let's say the first time we include this edge, we can increase our confidence for this pair from 80% to 99%. The second time we can go from 99% to 99.9%, so the second time may not be that useful. The third property is that the difficult pairs of records, they only contribute to the utility of pairwise tasks. And for this property to make sense, I need to first define what is a difficult pair. So let me try to do that. For each pair of records, there is an error rate. And there is a different error rate for multi-item tasks and a different error rate, as we saw before, for pairwise tasks. So we want to compute this expected error rate, and we want to compute the expected resolution cost if we try to resolve that pair with a multi-item task and if we try to resolve that pair with a pairwise task. And when I say resolve, it's reaching to a confidence higher than a threshold for that pair. So what we do here is we integrate over all possible error rates, denoted by epsilon here. We compute the probability of an error rate given the answers for that pair, denoted by A. And we also use, we also compute the expected cost for a fixed error rate. And we will compute the overall resolution cost using multi-item tasks and the expected cost using pairwise tasks. If the expected cost using multi-item tasks is higher, this means that this is a difficult pair. And that's why the previous property makes sense, which is, yes.
If you are characterizing new images, so let's say, for example, you have no label corresponding to this is Meryl Streep, right? And you're trying to quantify that whether this is image for Meryl Streep or someone else, how do you compute the error?
You have a prior also that can be updated. So you have seen all many pairs, let's say, in the beginning, before resolving that pair. And you know that the average error rate is around, let's say, 70%.
For
multi-item tasks and 95%, 30% and 5% for pairwise tasks.
Yeah, I understand that.
Yes.
I think your intuition was that certain kind of images are difficult.
Right? Yes,
difficult
yes.
Difficult can put in a multi-item task, which means that it is not a function of only the multi-item task, but what's there in the image.
Exactly, right? Exactly.
So you, are you extracting features from the image to help?
Not really. So the prior is used in the beginning to make a decision, right? To make a decision if I should place it in a multi-item task or a pairwise task. And you start, with the average, what an average pair of images would. But as you ask more questions for that pair, and you will ask a few questions because this can be those two images can be included in many multi-item tasks. And then you will learn more about that pair. And and hopefully you won't ask too many questions for a pair. The initial prior that we have, the bias that we have, is that go with a multi-item task. You want to explore first, and then, because you are not paying a lot with this multi-item task for each pair, you will very quickly find out what's going on with specific pairs. Yes.
So by harder or more difficult task, you mean where the answers are not converging fast enough? Where by including them in the multi-item task, you are seeing you are getting very divergent.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. So you will see an error rate which is very, very close to 50%. And the closer it is to 50%, the more answers you will need to. And if it's very high, actually, the error rate, you will never reach to a very high threshold, like 99.9%. I think that's true. So, you can compute that, you can examine all the paths, and that's what we are doing, all paths of possible answers, and in expectation, we know that we will spend $5 for if we keep including it in multi-item tasks, while with a pairwise task, we could just spend 50 cents, so it doesn't make any sense, it doesn't make sense anymore to include it in multi-item tasks. That's exactly the insight. Yes. Yes.
So what about the other kind of difficult task? So you mentioned you define the difficult task as it's more like a controversial pair, where some people, like half of people think they are the same person, half of the people think they are different persons. But what about the really difficult case that most of people think they are different persons, but indeed they are the same person?
Yeah. In that case, if the like. All we hope for is the majority of people to be. If you, in case that the error rate is more than 50% and much higher, that's a great question actually. Let's say that with a multi-item interface you get the exact opposite answer,
yes.
Right? Then you will not be able to. But this is I've never seen that in practice. You know, like with the multi-item interface, people saying. That the pair of images is the same person, and with the pairwise interface, everyone's saying it's a different person. I guess it happens, but not very. So what happens is the multi-item interface we have it biases people. It tells them don't put a color to two images that are not the same. So there may be some pairs of records that they don't seem to be the same person, and you will get more than 50% error because very few people will spot them as the same person or as the same entity in general. Yeah. While if you were asking explicitly their attention with a pairwise task, yes, you would get the exact opposite answer. Yes.
On this sort of coming along the same direction, yes. Do any of the crowdsourcing platforms that you're aware of give you some idea of which questions have been answered by the same human? So is it at least conceptually possible to sort of say, well, clearly this human is very accurate even for difficult tasks, so I'm going to give higher weight to his answers? Or is the identity of the answerers typically hidden?
Mechanical Turk gives you the idea of the worker. So you can keep track of the answers of every person, and you can find people that are spammers or they are experts. But this assumes that they don't have multiple accounts, because you will, I think I've seen that in some cases. I don't, like, usually I never block people, only if they are really messing up with but yes, I think it's a good point. Like, you can keep track, you can so what I'm saying here is that there is a different error rate for each pairs of records. There is actually a different accuracy rate for every worker at the other end. Right. Yes. So that's okay, great. So going back to the overall technical problem, finding the set of tasks that gives the maximum utility under the budget constraint in a current round. We have developed two approximation algorithms. The first one is a constant approximation algorithm. The second one is a K approximation algorithm. K here is the size of the multi-item task. So for example, for k equals 4, the guarantee that we get from the k approximation algorithm is that the utility of the solution we find is at least 25% of the utility of the optimal solution. So you can see here that the k approximation algorithm gives a worse guarantee, but it's much more lightweight than the constant approximation algorithm. And unfortunately, there is no hope in filling in the gap between the two algorithms with, let's say, a constant approximation algorithm with a complexity which is closer to the K approximation algorithm. And this is because of the approximability hardness results for the K denser subgraph. This is the real problem where this problem reduces to. But we ran some experiments with real data sets, and there is actually some structure in real data sets. At least in many real data sets. And based on this structure, we designed a heuristic that is as lightweight as the K approximation algorithm, but it gives results that are very close to the constant approximation algorithm. And I will show you some of those results in the experiments. But before going to the experiments, I'm talking about Waldo, but I haven't said who Waldo is. Waldo is this guy over here, and he's—I don't know if you know him. He's very famous from the '80s book series "Where's Waldo." So we were in those books. We were given images like this one, and we had to find Waldo in this image. So the way we would do that, we would scan very quickly the whole image, and we would find some promising areas, like the one over here. We are not lucky. The guy holding the yellow package is not Waldo. So we would have to go back, explore the whole space again, find another area, and this time we found him. So the way our system works with this model and algorithms is similar in a sense to how we would try to find Waldo. In the beginning, it uses multi-item tasks to explore the whole data set. It finds some matches with minimum effort from the workers, but it also finds some difficult pairs, which are, let's say, the promising pairs of records, and it asks for users to focus there using the pairwise task. So for the experiments, I have, I'll just say a little bit about the metric that we are using, the implementation of the system, and I'll just give an overview of the data sets. And then I will discuss just some of the main findings we have. The first for the metric. After every task selection round, we are computing a clustering given the evidence, the initial evidence, and the human answers. And this is just a simple entity resolution algorithm that we have in the experiments here. And we compare this clustering with the ground truth clustering. So the standard way of doing that is to compare two clusterings is to generate a set of edges for each clustering. For instance, we have A, B records here that both appear in the same cluster in our current clustering, so they form an edge in set S. And we compute the precision and recall of those two sets of edges, and then their harmonic mean, the F1 score. So this is the metric I will have in the plots. About the implementation of the system, the most important point here is that this task generation component that will get a representation of the task we want to send to Mechanical Turk, it will generate the HTML and JavaScript required for the task. It will use the Mechanical Turk API to send that, to post it to the platform. It will get back the answers. And it will, again, show the translate it to the representation used by the task selection algorithm. So the key point here is that those experiments would run for days or even weeks in some cases. And there are many things that would go wrong. So this component would have to handle many different types of errors. And unfortunately, there were some cases that something would go really bad and everything would crash. And so we also had to build some persistence layer in order to be able to resume an experiment and not lose maybe a couple of thousand of dollars that we have spent on that experiment. So this is an overview of the data sets. And I have here the type of the data in its data set, the sizes, and how we generated the initial evidence. And you can see here the sizes that are relatively small. And this is because what we briefly discussed before about blocking. So in crowd entity resolution, you first apply blocking. And then you have partitions. For example, if it's a cars data set, you have a car make block for each car make. And you'd never go and apply crowdsourcing on the whole data set. Of course, we did run experiments with larger data sets. And we saw that the gap between what we have and the alternatives grows. But these were only with synthetic human answers. So the experiments that I have here are with real answers. If we would have to do it with real answers, with like a 10x or 20x data set, we would have to spend a lot of money and wait. The main problem is waiting for months, maybe, for the experiment to complete. So there are two main things that I have in the findings that I'm describing. The first one is how well we are placing records in a task. So how well our utility function does and our algorithms do. And the second one is how well our approach that uses two interfaces does compared to an approach that uses only one of the two interfaces. So the first one is we have on the x-axis the amount of money spent after a number of rounds, and on the y-axis, the metric I discussed before, the F1 score. The higher the y value, the better. And we have two curves. One is the full system, and the other one is a baseline approach. And this baseline approach, again, it uses two types of the two types of interface. It also detects difficult pairs, but when it places records in a multi-item task, it does it uniformly at random. So it doesn't use the utility function and the algorithms we have. And you see that there is a 15x improvement by using the utility function and algorithms. I forgot to mention, this is the same data set as we have seen before. And this is actually the constant approximation algorithm. So if we focus here and compare the constant approximation algorithm with the other two algorithms, the K approximation algorithm and the heuristic algorithm, we see that in this case, the heuristic is very close to the constant approximation algorithm, and the K approximation algorithm is worse. In a sense, their guarantees, their theoretical guarantees, are aligned with what we see here. Now, about the interface selection. So we have the same plot here. We have two more alternatives. One is a state-of-the-art approach for pairwise tasks that uses only the pairwise interface, and multi, which is our system, without using any pairwise tasks. Without using any the pairwise interface at all. So we see here that there is a 2x improvement compared to just using the pairwise interface. And we also see that if we don't use the pairwise interface at all, just by using the multi-item interface, we are not able to resolve some difficult pairs of images. And for this reason, we cannot go in our final metric, the F1 score, we cannot go higher than 0.8. Now, if we see a different data set, and this has cars instead of people, and it also has some metadata, this is extracted from used car websites. So in this case, we see that multi is very close to Waldo, our full system. And pairwise, it's much worse. So there is a 3x improvement in this case. So what happens here is that for this data set, there are strong visual cues in the images, the headlights of a car, for instance. And the pool of workers we had in this experiment, they know about cars. So they could spot images that would show the same car even when they were presented with many images in a multi-item task. So in this case, multi is almost as good as Waldo and the full system. And the important point here is that you don't know in advance the characteristics of the data set and the pool of workers. So you need to learn about those characteristics adaptively, and that's what Waldo does, and that's why it's more effective than the alternatives. So to wrap up with Waldo, the problem is entity resolution, trying to cluster together records that refer to the same entity. And Waldo does that by combining some computer analysis algorithm or algorithms with human answers. It uses two types of interface. It will intelligently select which interface to use and which records to place in each task. And compared to baseline approaches, it can give a 15x improvement. Compared to sophisticated approaches that use only one of the two interfaces, it can give a 2x to 3x improvement. I don't know if there are any questions. I can go to the second topic if there are no. Let me then switch gears and go to budget allocation. As I mentioned before, in budget allocation, we want to split an overall budget for a data integration task that is performed using crowdsourcing in rounds. So we want to split this overall amount into a number of rounds. We want to decide how many rounds we should run and what is the amount of money we should spend in each round. I don't have entity resolution here. I have a simpler operator, the top one operator. This will better illustrate the key insights in budget allocation. So what is the top one operator? In the top one operator, we are trying to find the best element in a collection. For instance, the best description or the best image for a product, the best answer for a question on the web. Or here, the example that I have is the deadliest fighter of all time. So we want to find what is the ultimate fighter, and we ask humans pairwise questions. We show them two fighters, and we ask them to decide the winner of the two. So going to budget allocation, I have an example. Yes.
This is a subjective right?
Yes, yes.
That's a valid
yes.
example, or like I lost the connection.
Yes, again, you care about the opinion of the super worker, let's say. So you will ask a question to many people, and you will, in a sense, find what is the best option of the two.
But what is the guarantee that this crowd agreeing on something has to a general, like, for example, I can get a random crowd and let's say the crowd agrees on the guy on the right, but like because it's so subjective, and the guy on the left might be
yes.
for...
Yes, so it's a good point. There are cases where, let's say, the aggregated answer is 50-50, right? What do you do?
This crowd might think that because...
And another crowd may think, yes.
Yeah, especially with subjective things, I think, the main reason of the question is that,
yes.
is that another dimension that adds to your study, or is that something that or you would only limit to objective questions?
Yes, yes. So in this case, we assume there is a ground truth option, and we... yes.
Yeah,
sorry. Oh, sorry.
A
sorry.
Do you have any examples that are sort of more compelling for the top one operator? Right. Is there anything that you can sort of walk into a meeting mm-hmm. with executives and say Microsoft needs to spend $5 million on crowdsourcing because of these
of
use
this,
cases of the top one operator?
Yes. So I would say one of the examples I would think is, and I think I mentioned it before in one of the discussions we. Find the best candidate for a position, right? You are comparing, let's say, CVs, or you are comparing the overall performance of a candidate in an interview, and you want to find the best. There will be, again, a subjective. There will be people that disagree.
Then we are getting into much more tasks that need a lot of expertise, right?
Yes,
and
yes.
The question there is that
yes.
would you rely on crowdsourcing there where you can't...
Oh, no, no.
The worker
you, I'm just saying you would have
quality,
humans, yeah. Experts,
yeah.
Not
exactly,
not the
right.
crowd.
And that
yes.
is probably a different problem
yes.
altogether.
Yes.
or can you sort of... What are, in the systems that you've seen, what are the top one tasks that are actually being posed?
I think finding... The top one for this operator is the finding the best image for something like the best visual the image that looks best for a specific context, like for example for a product another thing I think is logos, like so you are trying to find the best logo. Again, it's subjective, I agree, but you can say there are three latent choices. It can either be one of the two is clearly better. Everyone agrees that it's clearly better, or the other one, or they are roughly the same. Here we don't consider roughly the same. We just say there is one of A or B, left or right.
Okay.
Yes. So this is the model we consider here. Yes.
So how does this compare to something like a pulse, like a volt, like pulse or volt?
Yes. So. Yes. So this is again. This is it's very related, and in a sense, we don't have to have just two options, right? That's what you're saying. You can have votes for many options and go directly and pick one of those options. The idea here is that we have a larger data set, many options, like many images in the data set, or many slogans for a campaign. And we want to find the best option. So you cannot be presented with 1,000 options to vote for. You want to go and ask for people their attention. They'll just focus on two options and will tell you just to be able to get a more objective answer if there is one. Yes.
So the other question is, like, how does this task relate to the other crowdsourcing task of sorting? Our list of objects.
Yes, this is also very related. Sorting, right? You
yeah.
said sorting. So here we just want to find the top one.
So it's more like a partial ordering. Sometimes.
It's partial ordering, yeah. And it's not even top K. It's just the best option. Yeah. Usually you care about the best option. Yes.
What about, I mean, just trying to find an example which is
yes.
More, what about like question answering kind of an example?
Yes, that's finding the best answer for, yes.
Yeah, where you, the task is basically to find the top one answer for a question.
Yes, this is. Yes, you want to. Yeah, it's a very good point. Like, of course you have other signals. Like you have the upvotes or the, but maybe it's again it's a difficult question. You need an expert, so you need to also be asking questions and waiting the answers that you get. To find.
Like you ask the questions, maybe you can use the search engine to get some candidate documents or passages or something.
Yes.
And then you want to use this technique.
Yeah. This is a great application. I think, like in web search today, we get some great direct answers for some questions, but some of the answers are not. It's just like, I don't know. Like I have received some answers sometimes that are not complete or maybe not the best answer that you can get. Yeah, you can and maybe for the long tail of questions, you can, in those cases, you need to ask humans directly when you don't have enough signal on which is the best answer. Actually, another example that I'm thinking now, it's not crowdsourcing, it's A-B testing, right? So each comparison can be considered as an A-B test. And you want, so you have many different options about the new functionality that you have in a product. And each option is a candidate, and each pairwise comparison is an A-B test that you are running. Actually, there is an even larger cost with A-B testing than a human answer. I think there are, of course, some specific things about A-B tests that the model should be different here, but I think it kind of fits even like the framework that I have here, this exact setting, it fits with many options and A-B testing for pairs of options. So let me tell you about the problem in this setting, which is the budget allocation problem. And I have a very simple example. So we have, let's say, 10 fighters, and we are eliminating in this case, one fighter at a time. We ask one question at each round. We eliminate one fighter. After 9 rounds, we would have found the ultimate fighter. And if every comparison, we need exactly 1 minute, we after 9 minutes, we will have the ultimate fighter. Another option is to go and ask all the 10 choose two comparisons in one round. And again, assuming no errors, assuming that each person needs exactly 1 minute for every comparison, we will need 1 minute overall to find the ultimate winner. So these are two extremes in this space where we have on the x-axis the overall latency for finding the overall winner and the cost on the y-axis. And there are many more options in between. So every option may have a different number of rounds and a specific number of questions in each round. And what we want is to find the option that fits the budget and gives the minimum latency. Or in other words, we have as an input the budget, B, a latency function L, and the number of items in the collection. And we want to split this budget, B, into a number of rounds so that the overall latency is minimized. And this function L models the crowdsourcing platform. It tells us that we will need LQ seconds to get back Q answers when you are asking Q questions in one round. So let me jump into the key insight that we have in this work, which is the key insight is that asking questions in clicks in each round is a very good idea. First of all, what is asking questions in clicks? Let's say that we have 12 questions that we want to ask in one round, and we have 12 options, 12 elements remaining from previous rounds. So if we want to ask 12 questions for 12 elements in one round, we would form 4 clicks with 3 elements each. A node here is an element, a fighter. An edge, a dashed line between two nodes, is a comparison, a question we ask to a human. And after this round, we, assuming again no errors, we will end up with 4 winners, 4 elements remaining from each click. And the good thing is that the elements that remain after a number of rounds, we can prove that they have the same probability of being the ultimate winner when we are asking questions this way. And this property allows us to apply dynamic programming to do the budget allocation. So to show that, I have a state diagram. For each state, we have the number of elements left, the number of candidates remaining. We also have the amount of money left to find the overall winner. And a transition between two states has a cost of asking the respective number of questions in one round. And the key idea here is that the optimal path from one state to the overall winner, to the state of finding the overall winner, this optimal path does not depend on how we reach to that state. And this is why we can apply dynamic programming to find the best path of states to the overall winner, and this defines an allocation. Yes?
For tasks with very high error rates, do you consider clicks where you ask the same edge twice to multiple?
Yes, so in practice, I'm talking about edges, and I'm saying that it's one question. It's not one question, really. It's comparison. We are asking it a number of times. And this is part of the latency function model. So it knows that in expectation it will ask five human questions for each edge. So it knows exactly what each question means, how much time it needs. Yes, sorry. Vivek? Oh, no. Okay. Okay, great. Okay, so the main theoretical result we have in this work is that by combining dynamic programming budget allocation with this clicks question selection algorithm, we get the minimum latency in the worst case scenario, which means that any other combination of budget allocation algorithm that someone can think of and a question selection algorithm, it will give a higher latency in the worst case scenario. And we also have some theoretical guarantees for the average case scenario. And we also saw that in mechanical Turk, in the experiments we ran, that this combination always gives the lowest latency by an important difference with the second in most cases. And we also saw that the budget dynamic programming budget allocation, it also works well with other question selection algorithms. So it always, or in most cases, gives the lowest latency with other question selection algorithms. And from my point of view, I think one of the main contributions of this work is that by doing budget allocation for other data integration tasks, we can also have we can also reduce the overall latency for the final outcome. And the right way to do it is to model somehow the progress the progress towards a final goal when we are asking a specific number of questions, we are spending a specific amount of money. And if we have a model which is stateless, like the model here, we can also apply dynamic programming and have an optimal budget allocation while the space of all allocations is exponential to the budget. Okay, so just a very brief overview of the related work in data integration and crowdsourcing. The main topics are crowd entity resolution, the first topic that I presented. Then we have top K and sorting, crowd latency, crowd databases, spatial crowdsourcing, data cleansing, schema matching, active learning, which is of course bigger than data integration and crowdsourcing, classification and clustering. And finally, I will, yes.
Some of the problems that you considered during the entire talk, right? Budget allocation,
yes.
Dealing with latency, dealing with errors, etc. These are pretty ubiquitous across almost anything that has to do with crowdsourcing.
Yes.
And given the huge literature, how do you compare and contrast your techniques, which are, in some sense, they are not fundamental to the
yes.
application domain in which you are applying it, they are more fundamental to the crowdsourcing. So how do your techniques compare and contrast against the related?
So let me start with the second one, the latency. I think most of the work that has been done is more general. Like they tried to solve a more general problem about crowdsourcing, which is great. Like there are some great key insights from those works. What we did instead, we focused on a very specific setting. Like we focused on this top one operator, and we focused on a specific model. And then with a very specific case, we tried to get some more general insights about budget allocation in data integration. And of course, there is more work to do. And how we do the same thing, for example, for entity resolution, it's not that clear how you can have a stateless model for your progress. So in a sense, I think we didn't, from the works I know, they started from a more general scenario. We started from a more specific scenario. With crowd entity resolution, there is actually some very interesting projects. In most cases, I think one of the differences is the humans are considered the ground truth oracle, and they are always correct. And we will finally resolve the data set by fully relying on humans, taking into account initial evidence, but just to guide the crowdsourcing part. I think what we did was, one of the work was also trying to, let's say, improve the evidence we have from humans to, and there is also, of course, work on active learning for entity resolution, where you are not trying to resolve the data set with humans, but you are trying to improve your model with the examples that you are getting. And there is also a work with that uses this multi-item interface, but it uses in a different way, very interesting work from Berkeley, one of the first works that started crowd entity resolution. And there the idea is to do the whole resolution in one step, not in the incremental way we are trying to do it.
So it seems that other approaches have tried a much more generic solution, but you were able to take some advantages given your specific domain?
Yes, with latency, I think this is the...
And in the first set of graphs that you presented in the first part of your talk,
yes,
you compared against a baseline, which I believe you came up with.
Yes.
Did you consider any of these generic solutions to see how much benefit you got by being specific to the application?
Great, yes. So this is one of the pairwise approach was one of the works from Berkeley, again, a very interesting work.
Okay, I thought that was kind of a...
Yeah, and actually this paper influenced a lot of other people, and they have approaches that they rely on the same key insight when you are using pairwise questions. So yes, let me just say a few things about some of the ideas and plans that I have for the future. My main goal is to be able to accelerate this process between data integration and data analytics. So I want to build tools, two types of tools. Tools, data exploration tools for business analysts and data scientists that will allow them to explore a data set without a lot of effort and find and try many different possibilities, and also data integration tools that will allow them to integrate information from new sources when, for example, they need a new feature or more training examples or more information for their report. And in more detail, I think in order to build some of the goals for those tools is for users to be able to guide users using those tools to interesting regions of data, to allow them to find correlations between features, get insights about designing new features, or instead of just looking on a metric like top 5 precision for a testing set on a trained model, to be able and explore interesting clusters of errors and get some intuition about how to improve a model or algorithm. And I think there are many challenges to build those tools, both on the interface side and on the system side. So for the interface, we need recommendations, auto-completion functionality, drag-and-drop functionality, and buttons instead of having to write queries and have a full understanding of the schema that the information is stored. And we need systems that will respond in milliseconds in all those user actions, even if they have to trade accuracy for performance. And for the integration tools, I believe we can also use crowdsourcing and fully automated approaches like machine learning, so that the machine learning approaches that can extract facts from external sources. And I know that at DMX we have done a lot of work on this. So the idea would be for a user to just specify the pieces of information and the sources that he wants the information to be extracted from, and then using crowdsourcing and machine learning to be able to import this data directly in the system and the user to be able to use it immediately. So I have two examples here, one for a data exploration tool and one for a data integration tool. This one is a tool that allows users to compare different regions of data. So we have worked on something similar while I was an intern here. This is slightly more different. Again, it's just an example that illustrates the main goal. So here, the user wants to compare Chevrolet sales with Ford sales. And what he gets as an output on the right is a pair of dimensions. And the tool here searched over all possible pairs of dimensions, which could be thousands, and found the most interesting pair of dimensions. Why this pair of dimensions is interesting? So for each subregion here, we give a color. And we give a color if one of the two companies dominates the sales for that subregion. So for some subregions, there is Ford or Chevrolet. For some other subregions, we don't have a color. And one criteria here could be the pair of dimensions that has the largest number of subregions with a clear winner. There could be, of course, other criteria. The user could specify the criteria, or the system could learn the criteria over time. I think the important part here is that the system can, in milliseconds, explore the whole space and give an interesting perspective on data without the user having to go over all the pairs of dimensions. And then the tool should also be interactive. The user should be able to click on one of those subregions, for instance, the Africa sales on sports cars, and find an explanation based on what the tool returns as a perspective on the subspace, on why Chevrolet is dominating the sales compared to Ford. And then this takes me to the data integration tool example. Say that the user cannot find an explanation on why Chevrolet dominates the sales on that subregion, so he wants to go and integrate new information from used cars websites. And the idea is that the user can just specify the pieces of information that he wants to be extracted. And then, because those websites, they have a similar template, each of those websites for every ad, we could have something like crowdsourcing to tag the pieces of information in each ad, and then use some algorithm, that, like data wrangling algorithm, to extract information from thousands of ads, and then use crowdsourcing again in a loop to verify the extracted information, find errors that are happening in the extraction, and in the end, converge to a very high quality extraction outcome with a very small amount of money spent on crowdsourcing. So thank you all for listening to me, and I'll be happy to take any questions.
This is
Can you say something about how this generalizes to other data cleaning tasks and your focus?
This one, right?
Yeah.
I think in many cases, in Wiki, for example, there are many clusters of web pages that use the same. First of all, this is just an example. This is one small thing we could do. But I think this regularity that we find on the web for different websites, they use almost the same template for parts of the website. Usually happens from you have a data set, you have a table on the data set. You have a database. You have a table in that database, let's say just a table, and this fills each row in the table, fills the a specific instance of the website. For instance, here we have a database with all ads, and every tuple in that table will give you a new ad. And of course, you don't have access to that database. But usually when you have a template, it's being filled by some set of information. So I'm saying because you don't have access to this set of information, being able to extract it using some combination of data wrangling and crowdsourcing. It's just one small example.
Yes.
So the idea is that I didn't say the details. I said about the specific structure we found in real data sets. And I think what's going on is if you see triplets there and you see the initial evidence, let's say, on triplets, the similarity on triplets of records, very often you will see that if two edges have a high weight, the third one will also have a large weight. So in order to find, we are trying to find really the k-densest subgraph. We are trying to find a subset of records that will be placed in a multi-item task that will have the sum of all weights will be high. Of course, there are many other things that are going on, and we don't just end up adding the weights. There is a specific metric, and because of linearity of expectation, we end up adding. But the heuristic is really that if you do that greedily, if you start with a good edge and then you start adding nodes there that connect to what you have already with large weights, you will end up building good subgraphs. You will end up building good multi-item tasks. And of course, doing it greedily for the general case will not give you any guarantees. But in most real data sets, you end up having something that has a good utility as a multi-item task.
Is it simpler or more complex than the other two approximations?
It's like the logic is all of them are fairly simple. Yes, the first one, the constant approximation algorithm, is using some modularity, but there is something specific on this problem, and instead of having it would have the same constant factor approximation, but it would be divided by two. That's the state of the art for the general problem. In this problem, you can go, you can go to 66% of the optimal solution, which makes a difference, I think, in practice.
Another question is, for the second problem, the top one operator, is there any study to show this pairwise comparison is better than, say, that we just ask a single question, show a single image, and ask people and see how many people think this is the best image?
Yeah, great. So a single image and rate it, right? Like give stars, for instance, that's what you're saying, stars, like from 1 to 5. Yeah, so there is a lot of work there, and there is actually one work that focuses on the maximum operator using both interfaces, tries to combine both interfaces. What happens in most cases is that people, if they don't have something to compare it, like an option to compare it against another option, they can. Some of them can give you 4 stars for the thing they like more, and 5 stars for the other thing that they like less. So they are not so consistent when they are. But for some points in the data set, this works well. Like combining the two interfaces works well.
Okay, I think we're also on time.
Thank you.